With the recent passing of Justice Antonin Scalia, attention has focused on the empty seat on the Supreme Court. Debates are swirling about Scalia's successor and what changes the appointment and the election could mean for our constitutional rights. But what does it really take to change constitutional law? Many Americans think that it is simply the will of five justices. But as David Cole shows in his new book, Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law, constitutional change is driven primarily not by the justices or the lawyers before them, but by the often unsung activism of organized citizens. David Cole is an award-winning constitutional scholar, a regular contributor to The Nation, The New York Review of Books, and The Washington Post. He is a leading civil liberties lawyer and a professor in law and public policy at Georgetown University Law Center. Again, the name of the book is Engines of Liberty, and we welcome David Cole to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
As a constitutional scholar and a professor in law and public policy at Georgetown University Law Center, what brought you to want to look at these engines of liberty?
I've been practicing constitutional law and teaching constitutional law for 30 years now. My sense is that when we talk about constitutional law, both in law schools and in the mainstream press, and even in our ordinary conversations, we tend to focus on the court, the Supreme Court, the power of the nine justices to impose their views of constitutional law on the rest of us. But my sense was that something more is going on, and that when you look behind almost any significant constitutional change, what you find is not that the change was imposed on us by five justices, but rather that the court recognized a change that we created through collective action, through civil society organizations that have a particular constitutional vision and work over a long period of time to get that vision realized.
So the activism of organized citizens.
That's right. If you look at how, for example, did marriage equality go from something that was unthinkable 25 years ago to something that was inevitable in 2015, when the Supreme Court was hearing that case. And, you know, it's not that the arguments were made before the court were different. Someone made an argument in 1972 that there was a right of gay couples to get married, and the Supreme Court dismissed it in a single sentence. It's not that the court was more liberal in 2015 than in 1972. If anything, the court has gotten more conservative. What changed was the background against which the court was operating and assessing this question, and that change was caused by gay and lesbian organizations, Lambda Legal Defense Fund, the NLGBT Task Force, the ACLU Lesbian and Gay Rights Project, the GLAAD, an organization in Boston, who worked over two-plus decades very strategically, very incrementally, to change the ground against which the court would be reviewing this question.
Is this a relatively new occurrence, or has this activism of organized citizens been changing things throughout our country's history?
So that's a great question, and I think, you know, some of this is old and some of it is new. So, you know, I think, you know, you go back to Brown versus Board of Education and the advances made in terms of the definition of what equality is required under the Constitution. And you see, on the one hand, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund filing lawsuits in federal court and making arguments in federal court, but behind them is an entire civil rights movement which is engaging this issue in the streets, in the legislatures, and the like. And it wasn't until all of that was brought to bear that any real progress was made. You look at the court's recognition of equal rights for women, and it comes against the backdrop of a political movement called feminism and a particular political movement to try to get the Equal Rights Amendment enacted. It was never enacted, but the court, recognizing that change, essentially enacted it through its own interpretation. So in some sense, it's been going on, but I think civil society has never been more robust. And one of the things I show in this book is that much of the work that's done by civil society organizations to advance constitutional law is done outside of the courts altogether. It's often done in state legislatures, in municipal city councils, even in private, private boards and the like. It's all about changing the culture so that an argument that on day one is seen as off the wall, on day two is seen as a sensible and correct view.
I do want to get to the three most successful constitutional reform campaigns that you focus on in the book. And I want to get to those in a moment. Before we do, though, what about an issue like abortion, where that activism of organized citizens is so strong on both sides of the issue?
Right. And that's often the case that there are going to be citizens arrayed on both sides of an issue. So, I on abortion, I don't think you can understand the Supreme Court's recognition of the right to abortion without looking at the kind of political work about reframing the right to choose that took place in advance of the court's recognition of that right in Roe versus Wade. And then you can't understand where the law is today without looking at the very strategic and long-term work of pro-life groups to try to overturn Roe versus Wade. And have they overturned it? No. But have they cut back on it significantly? Yes. And would they have cut back on it more significantly had there not been a continuing presence of women's rights organizations and right to choose organizations fighting actively on the other side? Yeah, I think Roe might be history if it weren't for those organizations. So one of the messages of the book is that, the constitutional rights are protected by courts, but their ultimate protection rests in us. And so if you believe in a constitutional right, whether one that's currently recognized or not, it's incumbent on us to engage democratically and politically with those organizations that are focused on protecting and advancing those rights. That's how the constitutional law works in our society.
The first part of the book looks at marriage equality. And when did this even start to become a vision? Because obviously the deck was stacked against these activists, and how in comparatively a relatively short period of time such progress was able to be made.
Right. So I tell the story in the book about how in 1983, Evan Wolfson was a Harvard law student and a gay student interested in gay rights, and he wanted to write a paper about arguing for a constitutional right of gay couples to marry. He went around to all the constitutional law professors at Harvard in 1983. None of them would supervise his paper because they thought it was so crazy, so fanciful. He finally found a trust and estates professor who would agree to supervise the paper. He wrote a 141-page paper. He got a B+. But he didn't stop there. He then went out, worked for Lambda Legal Defense, started his own organization called Freedom to Marry, focused solely on recognizing this right. It was a multi-million-dollar organization. It filed no lawsuits. It did all the other work that was necessary to sort of lay the ground for the ultimate victory that came last summer in Obergefell. And so, in the book, I try to trace the very careful strategic steps that gay rights organizations working together and strategizing together pursued, mostly at the state level, staying out of federal courts because they knew that the argument wouldn't succeed in federal courts until it had succeeded in a substantial number of the states. And only then did the issue essentially jump the tracks and was it ripe for constitutional recognition at the federal level.
In that most recent case, as you write in the book, Chief Justice Roberts objected that the Constitution, quote, had nothing to do with it. And you say that ultimately Roberts was wrong.
That's right. I think the Constitution had everything to do with it, but Roberts didn't recognize this bottom line truth about our constitutional law, which is that it evolves as we evolve in response to the kind of deliberate political engagement around core fundamental issues that these organizations were engaged in. And so, yes, the Constitution has everything to do with it. And the Constitution, you know, the Constitution today is very different from the Constitution that was adopted 240 years ago by the framers. And it should be very different. We are a different society. And for the Constitution to bind us, to guide us, for it to have legitimacy, it has to, in some sense, reflect who we are today, not just the views of a bunch of old dead white men who didn't even at the time represent the majority of the American people.
David Cole is a professor in law and public policy at Georgetown University Law Center and author of the new book, Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. You also look at the right to bear arms in the book, and you talk about how citizens seeking constitutional reform can certainly learn a lot from the NRA.
Absolutely. And one of the points of the book is that citizen activism doesn't necessarily move us in a liberal direction or a conservative direction, but that's where the action is. And the NRA is, you know, in some sense, Exhibit A. They are almost single-handedly responsible for the recognition of the right to bear arms and for the protection of the right to bear arms in the United States. Whether you agree with them or not, understanding how they did it is critical to understanding how constitutional rights are, in fact, safeguarded. So they faced a situation in which, while they believed that there was a right to bear arms, an individual right to bear arms protected by the Second Amendment, 100 years of judicial precedent said the opposite, and most legal scholars said the opposite. And so they set about to changing that, and they, like the gay rights groups, they focused on the states. They went to the states most sympathetic to them and sought to change their constitutions to recognize an individual right to bear arms, sought to enact gun rights laws in those states, and then expanded those to further and further states. They also changed the scholarly views on this subject by supporting scholars who took a revisionist view of the Second Amendment and argued that, in fact, it did and was intended to protect an individual right to bear arms. They put pressure on Congress and got Congress to enact two laws that recognized an individual right to bear arms before the Supreme Court did. And they even got the Justice Department to change its view when George Bush was elected and he appointed John Ashcroft as Attorney General, a longtime NRA member. The NRA reached out to Attorney General Ashcroft and got him to reverse the longstanding Justice Department position that the Second Amendment did not protect an individual right to bear arms. So by the time this issue went to the Supreme Court in 2008, they had sort of lined up all their ducks in order. And indeed, the Supreme Court recognized an individual right to bear arms.
You point out in the beginning of the chapter that Warren Berger dismissed the right as a fraud. So, and that was in the early 90s. So that's a long way to go.
That's right. It's so 1991, Berger, who himself was a Republican-appointed conservative justice, said that the notion that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms was one of the greatest frauds perpetrated on the American people in his lifetime. And yet, you know, just 17 years later, in 2008, the Supreme Court says this is not only not a fraud, it is a constitutional right. That is a remarkable shift, but again, you can't really understand that shift by arguments made before the court. You have to look behind those arguments, and you have to look at the political engagement in particular here, of the NRA. I think what the NRA understands is that there is an inextricable link between constitutional safeguards and democratic engagement. The most effective way to protect the rights that we care about is through democratic engagement focused on those rights. And that's what the NRA does. It grades every candidate for elected office at the state or federal level on their commitment to gun rights, and it urges its supporters, who are very faithful, to vote based upon that single issue. That's the right that they care about. They've been very effective at making politicians care about the right that they care about.
You make the point, as you did a moment ago, that the NRA remains a more important guardian of the right to bear arms than does the Supreme Court of the United States of America. What does that say about the NRA's power?
Well, it's quite remarkable. Although, and again, in some sense, it is a metaphor for the broader point, which is that liberty, the ultimate repository of liberty, lies not in the court, not in the Constitution, but in us, and the institutions that sort of bring that forward, that nurture and nourish that, are civil society organizations, nonprofits like the NRA. And yeah, it's more powerful. I mean, it's a greater protector of the Second Amendment in the sense that it can stop laws from getting enacted that the Supreme Court would clearly view as constitutional under the Second Amendment. And it can also get laws passed that no one would argue the Second Amendment constitutionally requires. So it's ahead of the ball in terms of protecting a right to bear arms vis-a-vis the Supreme Court.
So do you see an organization like that, and really any activist organization, of lessening that power, of how that can happen over time by the court and by other activists?
Well, I think the lesson is, Learned Hand, who was one of the greatest judges never to sit on the Supreme Court, he was a federal court of appeals judge in New York. He once said, "Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. As long as it lies there, it needs no court, no constitution to save it. When it dies there, no court, no constitution can save it." And that's an overstatement, I think. I think we need the court. We need the Constitution. But I think it recognizes an important truth, and that is that the Constitution is us. We are the Constitution, and if we want our Constitution to be robust, and if we want our Constitution to reflect our values, we need to get engaged. There are mechanisms through which one can get engaged on these issues, and I think what the NRA and the gay rights groups show is that a small group of committed people, well, in the case of the NRA, a large group, but groups of committed citizens working in a focused way can, in fact, change constitutional law to reflect their vision. And I think that's an empowering lesson for all of us, that that there's a democratic legitimacy to the Constitution. It's not something imposed from on high by judges sitting in robes, with life tenure. It's something that reflects the evolution of our society through political democratic engagement.
The third and final part of the book is Human Rights and the War on Terror. Does this all come as a direct result of 9/11?
Well, 9/11 was certainly the big spark here that caused a tremendous amount of overreaction from our government, in my view anyway, and in the view of many human rights and civil liberties organizations. But what I find sort of remarkable in retrospect is that by the time President Bush left office, he had essentially been forced to curtail many of his most rights-abusing measures. So he had, by that time, released over 500 of the 779 people held at Guantanamo. He had emptied out the CIA's secret prisons or black sites into which we disappeared terror suspects. He had suspended the CIA's torture interrogation program. He had suspended the use of extraordinary rendition in which we abducted people in other countries and then delivered them to countries like Syria or Morocco or Egypt so that their security services could torture them for us. He had put the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program, which he created shortly after 9/11, under the supervision and oversight of a court. And so the question I address in the book is, how did that happen? You know, George Bush didn't change his mind. Dick Cheney didn't change his mind. He was responding to pressure. And the pressure came, I argue, from groups like the ACLU, the Center for Constitutional Rights, Human Rights Watch, Reprieve, and again, working in large part outside of the courts to create pressure for rights that President Bush and Vice President Cheney ultimately had to respond to.
So with this point being made in the book that the activists and the activism of organized citizens play such a role in constitutional law, what does that say about Supreme Court appointments? And as we wrap up and we look at an opening on the Supreme Court, by pretty much anyone you ask, we have a very qualified candidate in Merrick Garland. So where does that put us in this time and show us the power ultimately of the court one way or the other?
So I think a couple of things. One is that appointments to the court are obviously very important and worth fighting over. They are one of the ways in which we, the people, are able to affect how constitutional law develops over time, by who we, through our representatives, agree to have nominated and confirmed to the Supreme Court. So this is all part of the same process. But I also think it's important to remember that constitutional law doesn't change just because you get a new member on the court. The Roberts Court, was a new court, but it has actually overturned relatively few constitutional precedents. It has altered the law. It has developed the laws in particular ways. But the way constitutional law actually changes is not by a new member of the court, but rather by this much more extended, much more democratic dialogue and deliberation that I illustrate went on in each of these three stories in the book.
Well, the name of the book is Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. The book is published by Basic Books. David Cole, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.